dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go,
you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, 101.1 Free Radio Santa Cruz, or Free Radio Asheville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Recently, a listener I ran into said he appreciated this show, but that it was guaranteed to make him depressed. That's, of course, not what I was hoping to accomplish by doing this show, which is 5 years old this month. The goal is to provide information and analysis that will help us understand why things are the way they are, and thus gain insight on what we can or must do to address the root causes of what is apparently an epidemic of depression. A recent article in the Washington Post reported that 1 in 10 American women takes an antidepressant drug such as Prozac, Paxil, or Zoloft. And the use of such drugs by all adults has nearly tripled in the last decade, according to the latest figures released by the federal government. Last year, the National Institutes of Mental Health, the NIMH, projected that clinical depression will affect more than 19 million Americans this year. That 1 woman in 4 will suffer from an episode of depression at least once in her life. That 1 American teen in 25 is clinically depressed. Major depression is the leading cause of disability in the U.S. and worldwide, according to the NIMH. Antidepressants and their growing use or abuse are controversies in themselves, but the point is that the number of people seeing doctors for the symptoms of depression is increasing. People with more than 2 of the following symptoms are urged to consult a doctor about depression: persistent sad, anxious, or empty mood, feelings of hopelessness, pessimism, feelings of guilt, worthlessness, helplessness, loss of interest or pleasure in hobbies and activities that were once enjoyed, including sex, decreased energy, fatigue, being slowed down, difficulty concentrating, remembering, making decisions, insomnia, early morning awakening or oversleeping, appetite and/or weight loss, or overeating and weight gain, thoughts of death or suicide, suicide attempts, restlessness, irritability, persistent physical symptoms that do not respond to treatment, such as headaches, digestive disorders, and chronic pain. So despair is being treated as an individual problem, a chemical imbalance. And the solution posed is a product, in this case a drug, to fix the defective individual. Researchers are now experimenting with implanting electrodes in the brain, somewhat like a mental pacemaker. What seems to be true is that being depressed is becoming the norm, and preying on the depressed is the stock in trade of the advertising industry, which strives to intensify feelings of anxiety in order to put forward alleged solutions, that is, the purchase of products to remedy the faulty individual, the empty feelings, whether a mouthwash or an automobile, 500 TV channels via satellite, Jack Daniels or Prozac. Now there are people who have contracted a new disease, shopaholics, maxing credit cards, unable to stop buying, seeking to fulfill yearnings that cannot be satisfied in this way. This week we're going to go to what I think is the heart of the problem, from which everything springs, that which undergirds our global social order, the market economy. The feminist thinkers we're going to hear from this week will not be talking about fair trade versus free trade. They are calling for a revolution in values and valuation, the end of the market economy, the end to the commodified life. They are very clear that economic activity is not a subset of political activity, one of many issues to take a poll on. Rather, that politics, the ordering of society, is based upon the economics of society, that is, how we meet our needs. How do we meet our needs? Believers in the market say that it is the best possible way to meet human needs, that when a demand exists, someone will fill that demand in order to profit, and thus a mutually beneficial relationship will develop. Problem is, that isn't what actually happens for most people. 1/3 of the population of this planet is literally starving. That is, they do not get enough to eat to meet minimum human nutritional needs. Yet this is not because of food scarcity. The very nations where starving people reside produce lots of food, which is then exported to people elsewhere who can pay the highest price for it. They, because they're poor, also cannot gain access to land to produce their own food, so they starve. Their governments ensure that they starve by making and enforcing laws concerning property. It is a crime to eat without having money to buy the food or land. But it is not a crime to control all the food and withhold it from people who can't pay. This state of affairs is what our saintly leaders call freedom. Political movements that have tried to address this all over the world are attacked, usually by the military of this country, in the name of promoting freedom. So, in effect, the right to starve is a freedom that governments protect with their armies. Is this sick or what? In a country such as ours, mountains of food are thrown away each day, much of it after having traveled hundreds or thousands of miles to get here. And even in this country where there is so much food thrown away, there are people who don't have enough food. And there are people who need homes. But no one is coming forward to meet their needs because they have no money. There are people who have homes, which are in need of repair, who live in run-down neighborhoods, but no one is meeting their needs because they can't pay. If they can somehow find a way to clean up their neighborhood, values go up, and they are driven out to make room for people with more money. People who are poor have exactly the same needs as humans as people who are rich. But the market concerns itself only with the needs of those who can pay the price. In fact, the market creates their poverty so that others may be wealthy. Markets are not about meeting needs or equal exchange. They are about buying low and selling high. For every person who bought low, there's someone who sold low. That was the poor person. Most people must sell their labor in the market in order to gain money to buy what they need. And many people, in addition to experiencing boredom, degrading treatment, pressure, insecurity, and sometimes injury in the course of this labor, are, for all their efforts, not even earning enough to meet essential needs. It's not that their employers are in financial difficulties. Their employers are often amongst the richest enterprises. They are amongst the richest enterprises precisely because their practices include such things as paying low wages. The market is about buying low and selling high, and thus making others sell low and buy high. Last Friday's Hartford Courant ran an article titled, Workers at Walmart, other companies rely on state-subsidized insurance. Connecticut lawmakers were outraged Thursday to learn that a state program meant to help poor families is footing the health care bills of workers at some major companies, led by Walmart. For families under the poverty level, Connecticut's Husky program provides free health care for parents and children. At higher income limits, which depend on the size of the family, the so-called Husky B program offers copayments of $5 for a medical office visit, $3 for a generic prescription, and $6 for a brand name prescription. A report given to lawmakers Thursday says the program is paying an estimated $43 million annually to cover workers at Connecticut's top 25 major employers. Nearly half of the estimated total covers the top five employers, including Walmart, Stop and Shop, Dunkin' Donuts, and McDonald's, all highly profitable companies. Lawmakers reserved much of their ire for Walmart. The retailer has 1,028 employees in the Husky program, or 11.3% of its workers in the state. Here is the richest retail company in the world, and we, the taxpayers, are subsidizing their coverage, said House Majority Leader Christopher Donovan. I think people aren't aware of the extent that we're subsidizing the biggest, richest, most powerful companies. Walmart shoppers need to know there's an extra cost of doing business. Donovan said that the state should consider writing a letter to Walmart, asking it to pay back the money in the same way that homeowners pay various taxes or sewer assessment fees. In an interview with The Current, a Walmart spokesman rejected the notion that the company is shifting the responsibility to the state for providing health coverage for the retailer's workers. We don't design our plans to be supplemented by public assistance, the spokesman Dan Fogelman said, nor do we encourage our associates to apply for these programs. But The Current noted that a congressional report issued last year found that Walmart had increased the health benefit waiting period for its full-time workers. In 2002, the waiting period jumped up from 90 days to 6 months. By comparison, the report found, the average waiting period for employers the size of Walmart was 1.3 months. The report also found that Walmart changed the definition of part-time in 2002, raising it to 34 hours or fewer a week, up from 28 hours or fewer, a stricter definition than many companies. And part-time workers must wait 2 years to apply for health coverage, and they cannot add a spouse or children. That from the Friday, March 4th edition of the Hartford Current. Now, are you ready for something completely different? How about the gift economy?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Fatima Alu. I come from Zanzibar, Tanzania, and I bring you the smell of the spices. Can you smell it? I'm very honored to chair this session on not a free market, but a market-free economy.
November 11th to 14th, 2004, more than 30 feminist speakers from 18 countries converge in Las Vegas, Nevada to discuss the gift economy. 2 years earlier, a similar event took place at the University of Texas at Austin. Today on Wings, we'll hear the first two speakers from that event, beginning with conference convener Genevieve Vaughn.
We've been having a conference now out at Stonehaven Ranch for about 5 days discussing from morning to night about the gift economy. This gift economy is an idea that I've been working on now for many years, maybe 40 years, and I'm so thrilled that its time has finally come when we're in an epoch of globalization and people can see how bad the market economy really is. The top 3%, more or less, of the population of the world have more than about the bottom 60%. And I'm part of that 3%. At least I was, that top 3%. Any attempt of mine to understand this situation in order to change it is immediately discounted by the ideology that serves to reinforce it, which is the ideology of capitalism and economic man, which says that self-interest is the primary human motivator. In other words, the market system validates itself even inside our own minds. Its mechanisms function inside our minds to keep us disengaged and apathetic. The saving grace of the economic man's self-interest ideology is that it can be extended theoretically to everyone in society. That is, we are allowed to wish for others the same benefits we have according to the same self-interest. From this idea, the principle of fairness arises without the need for other orientation. As someone who was born into a situation of enormous privilege, it was paradoxical for me to wish for everyone to have my same benefits. That would amount to saying that everyone should be part of the 3%, which would imply the same privilege over others. What is the way out of this impasse? There needs to be some way to validate other orientation that will allow us to try to solve the problems that our own society is causing worldwide and here at home. Otherwise, we are caught in this society contributing to the suffering of the many with our own well-being. It is nice to have more than enough. It gives you security and power. But when you realize that your well-being is the result of the suffering of many others, it becomes devastating, so that it is much easier to turn away and not see. The mechanisms of capitalism also blind us to the connections between wealth and poverty and provide a mythology of the reward of industriousness and luck, which grant privilege to the few. What we don't see is the transfer of wealth that is going on from the poor to the rich. We learn to look at it the other way around. We believe that the rich are giving to the poor. Our desire for altruism is satisfied by charitable acts, but we do not address the systemic causes of others' poverty and our own wealth. The paralysis and disempowerment of other orientation was my own situation 30 years ago when I was living in Italy. I recognized the dire situation the world was already in then. I believed it was due to systemic causes that could be changed. I had money and what would be thought of as a certain amount of power with respect to others who were powerless. But my desire to change things was not validated. It was not in my self-interest. During that time, I was working on a theory of language as gift-giving, as opposed to a theory of language as exchange, which my husband had developed. When I became a feminist in 1978, I recognized that there was a continuity between the gift-giving that I saw in language and the free work women were doing in the home. There was a lot of value connected with women's work, even though it was not monetized. Just as language produces values and value, which are usually not monetized. I began to see a whole area of life that was outside the market. I had already begun to look at the market critically, and I realized that exchange itself is not as simple and unproblematic as it seems. In fact, exchange, which is giving in order to receive an equivalent, is ego-oriented and self-reflecting. It is adversarial in that it pits people against each other so that each person is trying to get more out of the interaction. Exchange requires quantification and measurement and an equation of value. X amount of one thing equals Y amount of something else. Probably because at the time I was doing mothering of my little children, I realized that there is a more basic interaction than exchange, which is direct need satisfaction or gift giving. We usually do not pay much attention to gift giving because it seems natural or too simple to take into consideration. But it actually is a transaction and a logic itself. When one person satisfies another person's need, a relation is created between the two of communication and community. The giver has to recognize the specific need of the other person and make or find something to fill it. That means she has to pay attention to the other person and to the thing she is giving. The receiver recognizes that someone from the outside is filling her need. We do this kind of interaction a lot at all different levels, and in fact, we are usually sensitive to each other's psychological as well as material needs, at least in our families and our daily lives. The words communication and community actually come from the word muni, which means gifts in Latin. And that means that community and communication are based on giving gifts together. I believe gift giving is a logic. When we give to satisfy a need, we also give value to the other person by implication. Gift giving requires other orientation. It is not adversarial, but brings people together. It is qualitative rather than quantitative. It is transitive, and the good that is given can be passed along. The two kinds of interaction, gift giving and exchange, actually create human relations. And since we do them many times a day, they form our subjectivities more than we realize and make us into who we are. Because exchange is competitive and encourages accumulation for the self, the exchange paradigm or worldview competes with the gift paradigm, and it becomes much more visible. We are living in a world where these two worldviews are present in all of us. However, the exchange paradigm validates itself, and so we pay more attention to it. In fact, we give value to exchange, but not to gift giving. This has the effect also that we do not see needs as important in themselves when we are looking at life through the glasses of exchange, even though we may realize that many needs exist. There are all kinds of needs, communicative needs, psychological needs, spiritual needs, as well as material needs at many levels. The receiver is actually as important as the giver in the gift process, because without the creative reception of the gift, the transaction is not complete. If we concentrate on self-interest, as exchange requires, we are only looking at our own needs and at others' needs as secondary and instrumental. We even become blind to the variety and creativity of needs. They appear to be only an occasion to sell things. That treatment of needs is what is important to consumer society in creating many false needs. We are distressed at how all our relations have become commercialized and part of the market. Even at a personal level, everything is interpreted according to the giving in order to get an equivalent, the exchange way. On a more general level, everything that used to be a free gift is becoming commercialized and commodified. Water, which used to be a free gift, is being privatized to the extent that is called blue gold. Seeds, which used to be traditionally shared by farmers in developing countries, have become replaced by Terminator seeds there and are no longer available as gifts. Women's bodies, our greatest gifts, are commercialized through the beauty industry as if they are something that could not satisfy anyone's need without satisfying the need of the market first. But infinitely worse than this is the trafficking of women and children worldwide to satisfy the ego-oriented market needs of men. In fact, patriarchy has values that are very similar to the values of competition, accumulation, and domination that motivate the market. Patriarchy appropriates the gifts of women in much the same way that the market is now appropriating the free gifts of water and the earth and the free gifts contained in the cheap labor and resources of third world people at home and abroad. In fact, the economy of globalization can be considered patriarchal capitalism. The market actually creates and reinforces the values of greed, violence, harm in the support of self-interest. But we are not only creators of the market. Gift giving and language give us the psychological basis for a better world. They form subjectivities in alignment with the gift aspects of life, from our response to experiential givens to mothering, from our turn-taking dialogue to volunteerism. By expanding our practice and our consciousness of gift-giving, we can create an ideology which corresponds to unilateral gift-giving and which will justify giving and devalue war and exploitation. We can validate our other orientation and try to solve the huge problems the market itself is creating. 20 years ago, although the situation was already devastating for so many people, the market had not yet begun to seem so negative, and it appeared that it might be regulated for the good of all. My own critique of it, though, let me see how negative it was. I used my own theory of value to validate my other orientation so that I was able to justify using my money for social change. I realized also that women are doing gift giving all the time. Women are the primary bearers of the gift paradigm, the way of thinking outside the market, because we are called upon to do so much free labor outside the market. Our thinking derives from our practice and our socialization. Unfortunately, we have been giving to the market and to patriarchy. If we can begin to give value to gift giving, women are the ones who can lead the movement for social change to a possible world beyond the market. We need to connect the kinds of gifts we are already giving with each other, from housework to surplus labor. The reason gift giving is so difficult is that the market itself creates the scarcity by wasting the world's wealth on non-nurturing goods like armaments, and by cornering the wealth in the hands of the few, who then invest it in a stock market where it disappears in the roulette of speculation and corporate corruption. The self-interest that the market requires and promotes makes us spiritually poorer and worse people. Other orientation brings a variety of interaction and information that constructs a self that is multifaceted, fertile, and creative, as opposed to the self-interested self. We have become collectively self-interested as a society and self-reflecting. The more we act out the patriarchal values of dominance on a world scale, the blinder we become to the terrible damage we are causing through market mechanisms. People in the U.S. generally seem not to know about the harm we are causing. We believe other people hate us without reason. The media feeds this illusion. This is one reason why it is so important for us to listen to the women of the world. If we can validate our own motivation outside the market values, we can recognize their motivation and know they are telling us the truth about how U.S. corporations and policies affect them, their children, and their communities. We should believe them. I had a dream the other night of a factory that was locked up, and on the wall was a big picture that moved. It was beautiful to watch, but no one could get out of the factory. The vision, the moving picture, of a better world is not helpful unless it also includes a map of how to get there. The map has to include places we already know, places we can start from. To me, that means it has to first show the gift giving we are already doing, so we can recognize it, follow, and build on it. All of the women who have come to this meeting are major gift givers. They come from many different countries to tell about their situations, but also to find a common theme so that we can unite as women everywhere to oppose and free humanity from the system that is oppressing us all. We must believe these women. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jen. Peggy Entrobus comes from the Caribbean, and she's the founder of Dawn. Peggy Entrobus.
Thank you very much, Fatma. Let me say, first of all, how happy I am to be part of this few days we spent looking at the gift economy. When Jen first spoke about this in my presence, she gave me another way of looking at something that had been concerning me for many, many years. As a Caribbean person, I've never been able to understand how the majority of Caribbean people survived and live relatively well. I mean, there's no homelessness. There's no starvation in a situation in which unemployment ran to over 25%. So it was clear to me that something else was going on. It's not as if we don't know about poverty. Coming out of slavery and indenture, we had to start from the beginning to create new families, to create new communities. And the lot of most Caribbean people has always been very precarious. High levels of poverty, unemployment, lack of adequate services, violence. And many people have, in fact, migrated to other countries, to your country, to Canada, to Europe, in order to make a living for themselves. But up until the 1980s, I would say that our governments, coming out of colonialism, were committed to trying to create an infrastructure that would make life better for people. In those days, poverty reduction was not a project. It was the center of development planning. It was the center of the policies of the state as they responded to the realities of people. But after the 1980s, all of that changed. What happened in the 1980s is that Washington developed a set of policies that are actually very familiar to those of you who lived through the Reagan years. In fact, we call it Reaganomics, as conditions under which poor countries or indebted countries could get loans from the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. And those policies of structural adjustment devastated our communities. But the most serious thing that happened in the context of those policies is that it changed the role of the state. We were encouraged to believe not only that our states were corrupt, but that we could no longer look to our states, that our states could no longer be held accountable to people. Since the 1990s, that situation has got even worse as those countries of the North, the developed countries, have imposed on the rest of the world policies of trade liberalization, which we know as globalization. That has made life much more difficult for people who have already been suffering. In the Caribbean, and I think in many other countries in the Third World, people turn back to their survival strategies that were developed in the post-emancipation period, meaning that they depended more and more on the gifts that they gave each other. A variety of survival strategies, and I'd like to just mention a few of them to you. I'd like to mention, for example, a form of savings that is very common among, I wouldn't even say just poor people, but it's more important to poor people than to anybody else. Just before coming here, I was having dinner with an African-American woman who I'd known before, and she was asking me about microfinance. You know, microfinance, microcredit is the latest style in development strategies. And I was saying to her, you know, microcredit only puts poor people into debt. And we have a much better way of finding finance for poor people. That a group of people get together, and these are mostly women, and every month they put something into the pot. They put $10, $100, whatever they can afford. And every month, one of the 10 people, or one of the 12 people, draws that pot. And that gives them a certain amount of money that they use in very creative ways. They might use it for their children's education, to buy school books or uniforms, or they might use it to repair their house, or they might use it to buy a sewing machine, or they might use it to buy fruits and vegetables which they could then sell in the market. These are gifts they give each other, gifts that come out of their relationships of friendship, and they help each other in this way. But we've also got traditions, which again, I think you could find in many parts of the South and maybe in this country as well. In fact, I think I've heard of examples of this in this country, where groups of people and communities will go and help each other to clear the land, to plant the land, to reap the crops, and then they would move on to the next field. They help each other to build houses. They help each other to build roads and to dig wells. These are all gifts. They also migrate, as I said before, and in migrating, they never, in a sense, leave home. They may live in the north, but they're very closely connected still with their communities and their families. And they send remittances that sometimes represent enormous amounts of money. And sometimes these remittances are used for the family, but sometimes they go to create small businesses, to support hospitals and schools, and for small investments. And these remittances sometimes amount to far, far more than the wealthy countries give in aid. You hear about the aid that is being given, which actually represents a small amount of the money that is transferred from the south to the north. But you hear about this aid as if it represents tremendous generosity. You never hear about the remittances that go back from people that are working in these countries and send gifts back to their families that actually help their families to survive. There's one of the practices that women do when they migrate, and they buy a barrel, and they put that barrel in their living room. And every time there's a sale, they go and they buy clothes, and they buy houseware, and they buy supplies, and when that barrel is full, they send it back to their families and communities. These are just some of the examples. The point I want to make is not just that these practices are taking place. These are traditional, and in the crisis that we have today, more and more people are turning to them. The point I want to make is that having heard Jen talk about the gift economy, I realize that these practices, in fact, represent gift giving. Gift giving based on social relations, not just among kinship groups, but among communities. And the concept of family goes far beyond kinship. The important thing, however, it seems to me, and the reason that I've been very excited about this meeting, because this meeting is intended to help us to take this, the idea, the concept of the gift economy much further, to take it to another level, if you want, is that unless these practices are recognized as alternatives to the market economy, to the exchange economy, unless these practices done by women are recognized as challenges to patriarchal control, they do not present a political alternative to this market economy. Somebody said this afternoon, if you don't recognize yourself, it's easy to disappear. If people who are engaged in these practices, and it's mostly women engaged in these practices, do not recognize the value and the significance of what they're doing in relation to the market forces that are destroying them today, these practices themselves will be destroyed. So they need to be named, they need to be analyzed, they need to be recognized by the people that are doing these practices, not only as a challenge to the global market, to globalization, but also to the patriarchal control of these women. And it's only in that sense, and only when that happens, that it becomes a very powerful political process. I think that today, more than ever, as we see the war, the Bush administration's war against terrorism, paralleled to the corporation's war against poor people, today, more than ever, we need to find a source of hope. We need something that will help us to keep going. I've been tremendously depressed when I realized what the possibilities are for the future. And I think that in the gift economy, there is a possibility for that hope. The gift economy provides a possibility of hope. So I hope we are going to go back to our countries and to our communities and continue to work on this project in a very new way. I know that for me, it gives me a new way of understanding how Caribbean people have survived. And in that way, as I work on that, I think, and as I connect to women in other parts of the world, I think that we will have something to offer to people who right now feel the great darkness that covers us all. Thank you.
Speakers from the panel titled Not a Free Market, But a Market-Free Economy, held November 12, 2002 at the University of Texas at Austin. The speaker you heard last was Peggy Antrobus from Barbados. Dr. Antrobus is perhaps best known for co-founding DAWN, Development Alternatives with Women for a New Era. A network of women economic thinkers from countries of the South, DAWN has done much to revolutionize the study and practice of women and development. The first speaker was Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book Forgiving, A Feminist Criticism of Exchange. Vaughn is convening another conference on the gift economy in Las Vegas, November 12th through 14th, 2004. For information, check the website www.gifteconomyconference.com. I'm Frieda Worden for Wings.
And Frieda was at the 2004 Gift Economy Conference, where she recorded our next speaker, Jeanette Armstrong of the Zeeth people of British Columbia. This is Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Finner Syracuse, 88.1 ICR in Ithaca, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or Free Radio Asheville.
I just wanted to share my language with you and give you a greeting. I'm giving you greetings from all of my family and my community and my people, the Zeeth, and I'm also giving you my thanks that I'm able to come here to share some words with you, and I wanted to thank Jen for the invitation, and I wanted to also acknowledge Leanne and making the contact for Jen. I did prepare an abstract which I sent over, but I'm an oral speaker, and so that's how I want to speak with you. And what I want to do is I want to talk about a number of things that may be relevant to the conference here. I want to give you some idea of how I think about giving and the idea of gift, and I want to give you some idea about my own people's understanding of that in terms of the land and the community and the family and also the individual. In order to contribute to this dialogue, because something is really wrong out there, and it's the only thing that I can offer, and the only thing that I can give is my thinking and how it might work and how it might be incorporated or how it might be thought of in terms of the change that needs to happen is all up to you. I come from a small community in southern part of British Columbia in the interior. It's about maybe 200 miles inland from Vancouver, and about the same parallel. My people are sometimes referred to as the Okanagan people, but that's the valley, that's the geographic valley that we live in. We're the Nsiilichchin people, we're Siilich. And that's how I refer to myself. The area that I come from has a lot to do with what I'm going to talk about. The area that I come from is one of the only areas in Canada that's considered to be a desert, which means we have very little rainfall during the year because of the two mountain systems that that are on both sides of our valley. And It's very, the ecology is very harsh and dry in the summertime. And so that means that the learning that our people have had to accomplish and achieve over many, many generations in order to survive has a lot to do with scarcity and has a lot to do with survival. In a land where there isn't a lot of abundance, and in a land where the fragility of the ecosystem requires absolute knowledge and care, or you overuse it, or you overextend your use of it, it can impact directly on how much you have to eat the next year or the years after in terms of the survival of your coming generation. So a large part of our society and our community and our practice and our philosophy and our governance system are based on understanding that we need to always be vigilant and aware of not overusing, not overconsuming, and always be aware of sharing and giving, and always be aware that we're also, in everything that we're doing, that we're making the same possibility available to our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren. And so that's really an immense kind of responsibility. And I think of it in terms of direct connection to how the land operates, how the land gives life, and how you as a human being are a part of that. I think that has a lot to do with some things that are wrong from my perspective, that the land is the body that gives continuously, and we as human beings are simply a part of that. And what indigenous means to me is that the interdependence of everything that exists there must be understood, and I must have knowledge about, and I must be able to cooperate with all the other living things on the land so as not to make any one of them extinct or remove any one of them for my need. In other words, to cooperate and to collaborate with every living thing so that they can live and I can live in the same level of health, so that they can continue giving to me and to my children and my children's children the health that they deserve in being a life form. So indigenous to me can't be without that knowledge and that level of cooperation with the land. You cannot call yourself indigenous. This plant here was indigenous somewhere because it could live on its own in an interdependent relationship with its climate, with its land, with its topography. But once you remove it from there, you have to have all kinds of other things to allow it to live. All kinds of other kinds of energy and work has to be done to make it live. And this plant no longer is indigenous in this pot, in this room, in this place. If you took it out there and put it in the desert where we're at now, this plant wouldn't survive the day. And I think of indigenousness in that way, and I think of the paradigm shift that's required to recover the ability for human beings to live on the land without the kind of the immensity of destructive support systems that are required for this plant or for you. I think of that in terms of the way that all of those systems have been changed in my community in a forced way. I look at community next in that sense. I think about my life, and I think about not only how land gave me my life. Without the Okanagan land, without the Sealik land and all of the relatives that live on that land. Every single thing that sustained my people as food, sustained my people as medicine, sustained my people as clothing and shelter, all of those things that surround us, and I can only express in my language what meaning that has to me, and what meaning that has to be unable to protect that, and unable to stand between destruction and those things that are becoming extinguished from that land. Because of the depth of love and understanding that's required for us to continue to receive that gift and to continue to honor that gift and respect that gift. It's like family members being assaulted with your hands tied. And that, I can give you that feeling because you can hear it in my voice, is the same with community, is the same with all of the generations of relatives that have sustained each other, interacted with each other in really specific ways to be able to continue life. One of the things about the Nsilikchin people is that we've been described as an egalitarian society, and by some as matriarchal societies. And I don't want to go into the academic discussions about that. I just want to give you some idea of how our community thinks of itself, and how it thinks about what community is. To us, community is a living system, like the land. It's a living diversity of beings, and that diversity is immensely necessary, like the diversity on the land is immensely necessary. There's not one thing on the land that isn't necessary. There's not one thing in the community or one person that isn't necessary in our understanding of it. It would be like saying, well, I don't need my fingernails, or I don't need my toes. Just because you don't use your toes every day or your fingernails every day, that every person in the community fulfills a part that may not be understood either in this generation or the next generation or the coming generations, and that in like every diverse being on the land, and that we have no way of determining which is more important or which is less important, and that we never have an understanding in our community members that anyone is actually superior to another. And I think there again I look at how society outside of our traditional community operates, and the idea that there is clearly, my grandmother tried to explain to us in a lot of ways that we would have to find a way to be defensive against this, that there is clearly an understanding that some people have more of a right than others, that some people have more of a priority to things than others, and that some people not only are born with that, but are born with the control of and over that, and that they live and die with that idea of that privilege, that control, that exclusion of others. And I think that part has always been, for me, a real difficult thing. I relate to people in a really, I guess, in a really different way, in a sense, because that's how my community relates. I can't recognize hierarchies, and I don't recognize hierarchies. People are people in terms of how they relate to me. But But I notice it on an everyday level. When I go into, say, the community that I live next to in Penticton, depending on how much money you got and how much money you're going to spend, the amount of, respect, and I don't like to use that word because it's a problem for me, the amount of, the amount of respect paid to them is really related not to them but to their money and to their power and to their ability to spend. And that's so false. That's so unhuman and against community. That's so much different from our understanding of what respect is in regard to community. In my community, and someone spoke about the idea of chief here earlier, my community, the chief was, we have chiefs in our community, women and men. And the idea of chief has to do with how well that person hears everyone and how well that person understands what is going on that might be wrong, that might be cause conflict, that might cause danger to the people. And then the word itself, ilmichum, means to be able to take the many strands that are moving outward and twine them into one meaning, one people, a unification, a rebalancing with the land. And what that means then is that that person must have an immense ability to feel what the community is saying, an immense ability to listen to the things that have been said and the things that are happening and put that together and say it back to the people. So it's about communication, and it's about being able to listen and being able to put it together in a way which everyone says, yeah, that's it. And it's not telling people what to do or leading people or forcing people. It's in being able to verbalize and communicate what everybody else feels and knows and understands and remembers, and being able to put that together to create a movement forward. And so our systems rely on that kind of relationship and communications in our community systems. There's a process that I'm just going to describe to you really briefly, and I'll give you an example of it. I established an educational program to recover our traditional practices on the land and in our community and our families, called Inaukun, and I've been working at it for 25 years. The idea of Inaukun is a word that comes from our language. Inaukun wih is a word that describes how community should operate in terms of that kind of communication. How community should operate in our mind is to be able to include. It's an inclusion-seeking process, which means that rather than exclude the minority, we're actually trying to find ways to help minority articulate what they're saying, because minorities usually are saying something really different than everybody else. They're the ones that are experiencing something that really differs from others' experience in the community. And whenever there's an issue or a problem, it's that voice that's most needed. And it's the understanding of that voice that's most necessary towards resolvement. And if that voice can't find a way to articulate, can't be heard, can't be listened to, then we're all in trouble.